because there was a time before Convenia, and cats lived then too.
No. What happens, Convenia just helps keep the little nasty cats alive, you know, the ones.
Yeah.
So now I think we're selecting for nasty bacteria and nasty cats.
You could do a PhD on that.
I'm Gerardo Poland. I'm Hubert Hemstra, and this is The Vet Vault. Hello, Vet Vaulters, and welcome back. Our guest for today is Dr. Rihati Scarborough. Rih is a veterinarian and a researcher at the National Centre for Antimicrobial Stewardship and a PhD fellow at the University of Melbourne. Her PhD focuses on improving our understanding of the conscious and subconscious motivations behind suboptimal antimicrobial prescribing in Australian veterinary practices and designing sustainable strategies to support better antimicrobial prescribing in vets. Rih is particularly interested in the use of social norms and nudges to modify behaviour. And it's this topic that we'll be discussing today. But first of all, a huge word of thanks to the SVS Pathology Network for supporting this episode and introducing us to Rih and her work. But why would a pathology business want us to talk about how we use antibiotics? You would have heard some of the other episodes with their stellar crew of pathologists, and you would have noticed that it was all about pathology tips and insights. So why this topic? Well, if you think about it, your path lab is there to help you make decisions on how to treat your patients, right? And one of their goals when it comes to microbiology is to help you decide which drugs to throw at your patients to help them get rid of infections. Note here that I said help them get rid of and not drugs to get rid of infections, which is an important shift for me. And I think once you've listened to this, it'll be the same for you. But I digress. When we send our microbiology samples, the answers we want to get are, do I need an antibiotic? And B, if so, which one should I use? Now, traditionally, for me personally, and I'm sure for many of you, I would interpret the answer of which drugs I choose from as a, what is the biggest gun that I can bring to this fight so I can blow this infection out of the water? But what you'll hear in this episode is that we need to flip that around and say, what is the least aggressive approach that I can get away with? What is the most basic, least important antibiotic that will help me fix this patient? Or before that even, do I even need any antibiotics? So again, why does the team at SVS Pathology Network want us to talk about this? Well, it's because they realize that the decisions that they will help you make for your patients now goes well beyond now. They've been providing a lot of data for the research that has shaped the findings that you'll hear discussed in this episode and the recommendations that we'll share with you in the show notes. So they know that it is a big deal. I suspect that they would hate to be in a position, say, 10 years from now, when they have to start sending out results that say, resistant to everything, just as much as you would hate to be on the receiving end of that. So here's the deal. You're going to listen to this. And a word of warning, some of this might be a little bit challenging to you. I know it is for me. And then next time you send your sample to QML or TML or Vetnostics or VetPath or ASAP Labs or whichever one your local SVS lab is, and here's the cool bit, they're not going to sit that sample in the incubator for 2 to 3 days and wait for it to grow or not to grow. To identify the bug, they're going to put it in their new MALDI-TOF analyzer, which we talked about in our previous pathology episode with Dr. Kristen Todhunter. But if you haven't listened to that, what it basically means is that a laser will obliterate the bugs in your sample down to molecular size. And said molecules will then get sucked up in a tube and onto a sensor, which will magically identify your bugs pretty much instantly, instead of only after 2 to 3 days. We've put a link to a video about this in the episode description and in the show notes. And then, when you get your answer way sooner than you would before, you're going to use your newfound knowledge and the resources that we'll share with you in the show notes. And you're going to think twice about which drug you'll pull off the shelf. You're going to think about your dose. And you're going to think very hard about how long your course will be, because your current courses are probably too long, as you'll hear. I can tell you from my own experience since recording this episode that in the short term, this might be a bit uncomfortable. But what I'm hoping is that in the long run, this short-term discomfort will mean that in 10 years' time, we'll still be happily and effectively treating our bacterial infections. Please enjoy Dr. Rih Scarborough. Welcome to the Vet Vault.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
I'm very excited for this topic, and I'm also slightly nervous because I feel like you might
killed some of our holy cows in this discussion.
Not at all, not at all. And I think before we even get started, I would like to declare that I have never been a perfect antimicrobial prescriber. I've done all the things that I've now discovered are probably not the best to do in my PhD. But I think the key message with antimicrobial stewardship, which is that very long-winded way of saying encouraging responsible prescribing, is that it's not about being a perfect prescriber. It's just about making incremental changes to make better antimicrobial prescribing decisions. And when we make good decisions, we'll reduce the risk to future animals and future humans down the track. So, yeah, I'm not going to throw any stones at anyone. I'm not without sin, but I've got some insights that can help vets to make better decisions.
Can I start with a very, it's not a silly question, there's no such thing, but just so we can get clarity on antibiotic resistance, how does it actually happen? I've got a good idea, but is it literally just that every time you give an antibiotic, the only ones that are going to survive are the ones that are going to be inherently resistant? So we're selecting for resistance. You're not creating resistance. It's not like you are helping bacteria become resistant somehow.
That's right. The ability to resist that antimicrobial has to be there in the bacterial population, but you're applying that Darwinian selection pressure to all of the bacteria who are exposed. And I think one of the things that vets sometimes forget is that when you give a systemic antimicrobial, you're not just exposing the pathogens where you want to actually kill bacteria. You're not just exposing them, you're exposing all of the bacteria all over the skin, all of the bacteria in the gut, in the mucous membranes, in the mouth, everywhere, all of those commensal bacteria are being selected for the resistant strains. And then I guess the next step after that is that we know that bacteria will transfer genes of resistance between each other. So you might select in a perfectly benign bacterium, you might select for a resistance to, say, acephalosporin. But then that benign bug just sitting around might then pass on that resistance gene to an adjacent pathogen.
How does that happen?
Well, see, I'm not a microbiologist, but there's multiple different mechanisms they can do it. And one of the important ones is plasmids. And the problem with plasmids is that they're essentially mobile genetic elements that will jump from one bacterium to another. And often what you get in those plasmids is a cluster of multiple different genes that are all for different resistances to different antimicrobials. So you might, in one fell swoop, a bacterium might pick up resistance to cephalosporins, penicillins, carbapenems, all of the things that we have. That can happen in one go because of plasmids kind of collecting these resistance genes together. So that's why it gets a little bit scary. But I'm not here to scare people today. I'm all about, like, what can we do to be sensible?
I'm glad I asked that because that's new to me. I thought it was just, well, if there are some that are resist, but that passing it on, that is a bit scary.
It is a little bit scary, yeah. So I think it's important to bust some of the myths that are holding us back from better prescribing so that we can reduce our risk of those sorts of events that will give us some really difficult to treat infections in the future.
Obviously the way to not, like the way to manage this plasmid thing is obviously not to just add more antibiotics and just try to kill everything in one go. Just like kill everything.
Yeah. Look, it's funny. I've done some interview studies with vets and with clients as well to understand what they think the point of antimicrobial treatment is. And people do often say things like, oh, we need to wipe out all the bacteria in the infection. We need to wipe them out. And I guess one of the messages I would like vets to take on board is that you'll remember in your lectures back in microbiology that we're not dealing with just an isolated population of bacteria just sitting in a dish. We're actually, it's a balance between the animal's immune system and the replication of the bacteria, right? So the point of giving antibiotics is not to completely wipe out all the bacteria that are present in the infection. The point of it is to tip the balance in favor of the immune system. The immune system's already doing its thing, trying really hard to get rid of these pathogens, right? all you need to do is slightly tip the balance in favor of the immune system, and all of those amazing lymphocytes and macrophages will come in there and do the rest of the job, and the neutrophils, they will clean up the rest of it. But we just need to tip the balance in favor of the animal rather than the bacteria. And so one of the antibiotic myths that I wanted to bust today is this really old concept of we must finish the course of antibiotics in order to avoid antimicrobial resistance.
Whoa, okay, here we go.
Yeah.
I was told that just recently.
Who told you that, Gerardo?
I'm fairly certain Hubert told me to do that, so.
I saw it on Facebook.
It's not saying that having a certain number of treatments is not important. It's that, but there are a few problems with this mantra of finish the course that we've all become so attached to. And I think, you know, at the root of that is that theory that I was just saying, that the aim of antimicrobial therapy is not to wipe out all the bacteria.
And I'm going to interrupt because I'm glad you said that, because when you say it, I go, yeah, duh. But in my head, I am, when I put that animal antibiotics, I'm like, take that. I'm going to wipe.
Yeah. And then you think, oh, I've treated this UTI, the urine should be clear of bacteria, right? That's another thing that people do. Like, oh, I'll do another cystocentesis. Oh, there are bacteria. There shouldn't be bacteria in normal urine from the bladder. Let's keep giving it antibiotics. Mm. That happens a lot. So subclinical bacteriuria does not need to be treated.
Okay.
Oh, that's weird. That's a weird one for me. We'll come back to that one.
Oh, is it? Keep going. Okay. Well, I'm willing to be told off, but the guidelines say unless there's symptoms, you don't treat. But the issue with finishing the course is that the traditional courses of antimicrobials have been determined in a really very arbitrary way. It's not, I mean, have you ever thought it's slightly strange that we do so many multiples of the number 5 or the number 7 in our antimicrobial courses, as if that's some sort of magical threshold for bacteria? Or like, it's not. It's something that people do 5 days and 7 days in their head quite well, because their heads revolve around a week. But there is nothing special about that. And actually, a lot of the trials that have led to us saying, well, we need to treat this for 7 days or 14 days or whatever it was, they are done by drug companies, and they need to do it to register their product. Their motivation is not to discover what is the minimum effective duration in a condition. They just want to find a duration that works. And in fact, if you're a cynic, you might say they're actually motivated to find out quite a longer duration than is necessary, because they would like you to use more of their product. But actually, wherever clinical trials have been done in human medicine, and increasingly now in vet medicine, to discover how far can we cut this course of treatment back before we start having an inferior result, almost in all cases, we've found that shorter courses work just as well and reduce the chance of adverse effects from the direct adverse effects, as well as antimicrobial resistance. So, yeah.
We talk about multiples of 3 instead of 5 or 7.
Well,
because
I guess
if you keep on going, you'll get multiples of 3 in 5 and 7, you know, 21 and 15.
Yeah, yeah. How do you decide when what is long enough?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends is the answer to that, Gerardo. I think, and how do you decide? I think, you know, for common conditions, there are independent prescribing guidelines available from the University of Melbourne website, and you can also find them on the pretty new website called the AMR Vet Collective. That's an Australian university based website where you can find lots of free resources. So you can find guidelines to give you an idea of how long common conditions need to be treated for. Obviously, not all of the cases we see in clinical practice are going to fall into those common lists. And they also, you know, there's variability in different cases. Some animals have less of a competent immune system, all of that. So it's not saying you must use this amount, but starting with what's written in the guidelines is probably a good way to go. So you might look at the guidelines, say, for a sporadic UTI in a dog, and it says 3 to 5 days of amoxicillin or trimethoprim sulfonamide. And that is it. So a lot of vets I spoke to were really surprised about that. They haven't got the guidelines, and they have been treating for 14, sometimes 21 days to really wipe out those bacteria, but actually it's just not necessary. And if you think about how much extra exposure all of the commensal bacteria have had in that time, the extra 10 days that you've given that you didn't need to give, those are easy wins for us in terms of reducing our impact on antimicrobial resistance. So if we can just get to the guideline recommendations, we will be making a huge difference.
I think that makes sense in a way, especially when like rolling what you said before, which was tipping the balance in favor of the immune system. You know, like we don't want to annihilate them because we'd be annihilating other things as well.
Yep.
And we just need to make sure that we get the low enough or get rid of enough that the immune system continue on with the job or something like that.
Yeah.
So does that come down to clinical signs then?
Yeah, I think where we don't have a clear guideline, I think you need to be guided by clinical signs. In human medicine, they're increasingly using, especially in the hospital setting, they're using biomarkers, things like procalcitonin and C-reactive protein, to see where patients are at in terms of their recovery from an infection, especially when there are infections you can't really see or don't have really obvious signs on the outside, that those sorts of things, they're using those as markers to see when can we stop antibiotics. Those are going to be a little bit harder to do in veterinary medicine, but I think clinical signs is a really good way to gauge how you're going with the infection where you don't have guidelines.
So would other biomarkers be things like, you know, let's say you had pyelonephritis and then you had an azotemia or something, clinically looking better, but then the azotemia is still there. You'd continue for longer until the azotemia might resolve, or is it that's only a biomarker that's kind of like?
I think that's a tricky one because that's more about regaining function, isn't it, rather than the inflammatory process calming down. I think if you wanted to look for a biomarker there, it would have to be something more to do with the response to the infection.
Like inflammatory numbers, cell numbers, or?
CRP. And we it'd be an interesting one because in my last clinic, we started using CRP, so canine reactive protein, quite a bit. And that might be useful. But again, we won't dig down that rabbit hole too far. Unless you know anything specific.
I'm certainly no expert in that area, but I think just to have the concept that that's where we would like to move towards, thinking about how is this animal going, rather than saying, I need to treat this for exactly 21 days, like that's some sort of magical thing. And then that if I get to that point, then I will somehow avoid antimicrobial resistance.
I just want to unpack the theory that started the whole, well, if you don't finish the course, you're more likely going to get resistance. So was the thinking that if you haven't killed it properly, and there's still bacteria hanging around, that's going to rebound and it's going to be the ones that are more resistant? Is that because that's sort of how I thought about it. And is that not true?
Well, that is why it came about. It's the idea that, you know, if you did not finish off the pyelonephritis, if you didn't get rid of the bacteria in the kidney, that those ones that were remaining when you took off the brakes of the antibiotics, they would be really difficult to treat, and then you would end up with a bigger problem. That's, you know, that, and that is, I guess, true to some extent, but I guess what I'm saying is that the courses generally that we've decided for a lot of things are far more than we need to get to the point where the body is winning the fight, you know, in the kidney, in the bladder, in the skin. We're just generally overdoing it, and it makes us feel safe, and it makes us think, oh well, I can sleep better at night knowing that client's not going to come back with something returning. But we need to start looking more closely at following the guidelines, which are based on evidence.
What other kind of things that we do as a, you know, practice, like, you know, like humans, vets, you know, what are the kind of things you talked about, our recommendation to finish the course? What other things increase resistance? Could it be like underdosing or something, not like going to the right frequency of dosaging, or?
Yeah, I think all of those things do contribute and are responsible for encouraging resistance. But I think, you know, it's hard to say what contributes the most, but I think underdosing, the concept to focus on is this mutant selection window, which is sort of the concentration that is enough to select for the mutants that, that have the resistant genes, but not enough to kill them. So it, the longer you put an animal into that, that sort of band of antibiotic concentration where you are selecting for mutants but not actually getting rid of them, the more resistance you get. Now, that's not to say that the immune system won't get rid of some of them. It will, but consistently giving too low a dose is definitely problematic because it tends to keep animals in that mutant selection window.
So if you stuck to the general dosage regimes, it's pretty hard to underdose.
Well, depends where you get them from. So if you get your dosage guidelines by reading the bottle, that is not always going to be correct. Some of my supervisors have written articles about the problems of antimicrobial labelling in Australia. Some of the label claims of dosages have been subsequently shown to be completely incorrect, particularly in equine medicine. There's been some serious underdosing of gentamicin. So there's some attempts to get that rectified. So I guess, and I couldn't possibly tell you all the ones that are correct or incorrect. I think in small animal medicine, there are fewer problems, but I think in general, it's best to look up a different resource other than the label to figure out what dose you should be giving and how often. So yeah, we've got from the University of Melbourne, as well as the prescribing guidelines, which will tell you which drugs to choose for how long. We now have a new resource called the antimicrobial. We've been calling it the flip book. It's like a little book with dog and cat in the front. And it has also recommended dose rates and frequencies for the drugs based on evidence. So that's the kind of place you might look for a really reliable dose rate.
So basically the message is that when you use an antibiotic, you are potentially going to help select for resistance. So be mindful about when you use an antibiotic, basically. Just don't unnecessarily use it when you need to, because every time you do, there is a small risk that you are going to select for the ones you don't.
It's about right, but I would be even stronger than that. I would say every time you use an antibiotic, you are selecting for resistance. You don't know about it because you're not testing for it. But when they've done studies of, say, fecal samples in an animal that's been exposed to systemic antibiotics, the resistance that has been selected for in all of those commensals that live in our guts or in the animal's guts, you can still see the evidence of that course of antibiotics years down the track. So I used to think, oh, well, surely, you know, after a few months, everything's kind of, once you've taken off that selection pressure, it will all settle down and everything will be back to normal. But actually, the resistance that you've selected for can persist for years. And I think that the study that I read most recently said even in some animals, there was evidence even 4 years after the course of antibiotics. I mean, those are probably just resistance genes just sitting there, not really doing very much, not affecting anyone. But every time we select for those, we are increasing the risk, and that animal can then pass on those genes. You know, those gut bacteria end up somewhere, maybe in the owner, maybe in the water supply, maybe in wild animals. We are living in one big microbial soup, and everything that we do has flow-on effects to other species and each other.
All right. You mentioned something earlier, sort of in passing, but my ears perked up. You said amoxicillin instead of amoxiclav when you talked about UTI. Yeah. Is that specifically for you? Well, I haven't used straight amoxicillin almost ever in 20 years of veterinary science. Like, it's there on the shelf, but should we be using it more? Okay, it's just that, look, amoxiclav is just probably the most used small animal antibiotic. And I know it's
kind of like lazy antibiotic. You don't want to think. You just go,
And I know for a lot of instances, it's probably too heavy handed. But again, it comes back to that thinking, which listening to you now sounds like it's erroneous, but that, well, I'm going to do it properly. If I'm going to treat it, let's print it properly and let's not go half-assed and take amoxicillin and then select for a larger number of resistant bugs. That's sort of what my thinking was, but I'm obviously wrong.
Well, yeah, which is, that's exactly how a lot of people think about it. And what I would like to do is flip that and say, when you add clavulanate to your amoxicillin, what are you adding it for? Like, what is the extra spectrum that you want to get from it whenever you add the clavulanate?
It just sounds better.
No, because it's because a bunch of the staffs. Oh, this is gonna. I'm gonna edit all this.
Yeah.
You get it wrong.
But they make.
If you get it wrong, I'll give it a go after.
They make something that sort of neutralizes your antibiotic that protects them against the antibiotic.
Yeah.
The clavulanate counteracts that. Yes.
Yeah. So you're talking about beta lactamase? Is that?
That's the word. I know.
Yeah, clavulanate is good if you have beta lactamase production in the pathogens that you are targeting. But I think you might be surprised how rarely you have a beta lactamase producing pathogen.
Really?
It's not as common as vets think. In fact, I got some data from ASAP Laboratory in Victoria and looked at all of their culture and susceptibility results from 2021. And in dogs, for non-urinary samples from dogs, now, I don't know which body sites they came from. They would have been, you know, skin swabs, all sorts of swabs. 6% of the isolates would have benefited from the addition of clavulanate. So that's not very many. In urinary isolates, it was 11% would have benefited from clavulanate. So most of the time, you will get no benefit from clavulanate. And actually, in UTIs, let's talk about UTIs, because I did a big study in UTIs. And in dog and cat UTIs, 94% of infections can be treated with a low-importance antibiotic. Now, is the importance of antibiotics a concept that you've been exposed to? Different importance levels?
Like first order, second order?
Yeah. So yeah, we sometimes, I think in some cases they've been called first, second, third line, but we're now switching to calling them low, medium and high importance. And the rating system is about how bad it would be if we got resistance to that particular antibiotic. And so high importance, really bad. We don't have many options left to treat the pathogens that affect us. Low importance, we put those in green color sometimes just to highlight that they are the ones we should be using preferentially.
Yeah.
If we get resistance, we've got heaps of options up our sleeve. When I say heaps, more options than the other ones. So that's a really good way of thinking about how you use antibiotics. Go for the green end of the spectrum, avoid the red end of the spectrum.
I like that. You get like, I can almost imagine one having this little flip chart book thing with the antibiotic selection guidelines, but then also just like a color coding system next to the antibiotics. It's like, don't touch the red unless they're about to be dead or something like that.
Oh, I love that.
make the red ones really hard to open. You have to go get a nurse.
It's like you make them click, push down, click, rotate, and peel back, and have the cotton ball in there, as well as make them really, really, really small.
You need two people to open it. Like you literally can't. Yeah. It's like a button that somebody has to push while you're.
Yeah, it's actually been done. So we have some really cool little charts for different species of the antibiotics that are available. In green, yellow, and red dots showing, listing the ones that we should be using more of and the ones we should be using less of. So Agricultural Victoria has those freely available, and you can print them out and put them up in your clinic. But yes, putting red dots on the drugs that you want people to avoid using is something that we've done as part of a antimicrobial stewardship trial with a bunch of clinics. And it does seem to affect people's behaviour. And exactly what you said, Hugh, as well, making it less accessible. Now, if you put the antibiotics you want people to use at eye height and you put the other ones somewhere where people have to climb onto a ladder, guess what people will use?
yeah.
But yeah, use amoxicillin more. It's a low importance antimicrobial and it's super effective in lots and lots of conditions in animals. So it's a good place to start. Whereas amoxiclav, you've added spectrum. It goes into the yellow zone, the medium importance antimicrobials, and it's just not necessary so much of the time. I know, we love it, but it's...
So I can tell you why we do it. As a profession, we don't like failure and we don't like not treat things effectively. So if you say the percentage of when it's not going to work, doesn't sound like a mm-hmm. lot, but if you say to me, 1 in 10 out of the cases that you treat is not going to work, mm-hmm. and your clients are going to be pissed off, mm-hmm. they're going to come back and say, look, we've been here, it's no better. Yep. Then I'm going to go, I'm not happy with that. So it'll take a mind shift and it'll take better communication with clients and better follow-up probably to start getting these into a clinic. Because I don't like failure. I don't want my cases to come back not better.
Yeah,
ever.
I totally get that. And I think that is a key thing for us to keep in mind. But, I mean, I guess, yeah, if you can communicate to the client about what might happen so that it doesn't catch them by surprise if, for example, 3 days into just getting amoxicillin that it's not improving and you've explained what the plan is if we get to that point, then I think most actually the clients that I spoke to, I did interviews with clients and I did surveys with over 500 smallies clients, and generally speaking, as long as they understand, as long as someone communicates to them what to expect, they're generally pretty happy with whatever you decide is the right thing to do. And a lot of them are aware of antimicrobial resistance and are concerned about it. They don't necessarily understand it in depth, but that's okay if you explain that the reason that you're doing it is you want to avoid using clavulanate unnecessarily, for example, and say, well, we might get a situation where you have to come back and we'll have to change you to a different antibiotic. I think that's okay.
Well, look, that approach that I just said is also very short-sighted, because I go, well, I don't like failure, but then I'm setting myself up for massive failure 10 years down the line because I've got nothing that works.
I agree with you. You said that most clients may not really understand, but they understand or they know that antibiotic resistance is bad.
Yeah.
Right. And now that I've started to have a conversation, give them a choice and go, hey, look, what we could do here is give some antibiotics, but actually it may not make a difference. And studies have shown that it actually, you know, your pets will probably do likely just as good without them. You know, my preference would be to not prescribe antibiotics, but if you...
Yeah, especially when it's not life and death, isn't it? It's not like, you're not going to take a gamble when it's... Well, I think it's maybe septic, but let's see how we go.
Okay. Especially when there's guidelines saying like the longer you wait before giving antibiotics to a septic patient, the more likely they're going to failure. But I've had that conversation hundreds of times recently, the last couple of years, and owners like overwhelmingly select not to use it and then are aware of the thing. And I type in my notes because we always give a discharge summary, and it says, if you see any of these signs or there's no improvement within the next kind of 24, 48 hours or something, then come back, free consult or whatever. We reevaluate the need for antibiotics. Yep.
And that's a really good technique, is to leave the door open and say, you know, we might have to go down this path. I'm not saying no, I'm just saying not yet, which completely changes the conversation with someone who's come in with this expectation of antibiotics. If you don't say no completely, but you do say, look, you know, for now, I don't think it's in the best interests of your pet to do this. I think they really respond to that. And a lot of the clients that I spoke to said they saw the vet as an advocate for their animal. And so if you frame it in a way that says, I am doing this in the best interests of your pet, because I want your pet to get better, but I also want your pet to avoid complications that can happen when we give antibiotics. So this is what I think is the best plan for your animal. I think what I learned from speaking to clients is that saying, I don't want to give your pet antibiotics because public health, blah, blah, blah. You know, we have issues. You know, there are people dying in hospitals of tuberculosis that's multi-drug resistant. It's too much of a leap for people to think about in that moment. I mean, they, you know, they sort of, they do care about that, But in the moment that they're seeing you, that's not what they care about. What they care about is their animal getting better as soon as possible. And they want to know that you are doing the best thing for their animal. And I think if you can get them to believe that, then they're generally going to be happy with it. I mean, there's always the odd person who won't be happy with anything, but it's really, really important for vets to, at least in that situation where you're deciding not to give antibiotics, appropriately deciding that antibiotics shouldn't be given, if you make it clear that, like you said, Gerardo, that it won't help, giving antibiotics won't help your pet get better any faster, because that is what they think. When they come in saying, I really want my dog to get antibiotics, they're saying it because they think it's going to relieve their animal's suffering faster, and that is their priority. So if you can underline that it won't help because it's a virus or whatever, and that you're also addressing the discomfort that they are seeing in their animal, then that's most of the issue that's solved. And clients really, I think, you know, 98% of them are going to be fine with that.
So you mentioned the bacteriuria, that if it's not symptomatic, it doesn't need treatment. Are there other common clinical scenarios where we probably abuse antibiotics, where we reach too quickly for the bottle of Clav, or I'll talk about Convenia later.
Or Convenia. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, can we talk about tablet in cats as well?
Yeah,
but yes, so we've done some analyses of prescribing of antibiotics across lots of clinics. We've looked at pet insurance data, which has given us, you know, millions of consultations where a claim has been made. And we've also had some access to some prescribing data from a group of clinics contributing Vet Compass. And what we've found is that there are quite a few inappropriate uses of antibiotics. One of them where the guidelines say no antibiotics are required, but so many vets give antibiotics, is the catfight abscess.
I've heard of this heresy.
I've never done that ever.
Given antibiotics or not given antibiotics?
He's a liar.
Never given antibiotics, I think, is the right answer to that one.
But actually, I mean, you would be in the tiny minority if that was true.
it's just because it's pus.
Oh my gosh, you're not the only
it's
one who said
pus,
that.
Isn't it?
One vet said to me when I interviewed them, she said, well, I can see and smell and almost taste the pus, I can't not give it antibiotics to clean that up. And I'm like, yeah, I get that reflex. Like, it's gross. You want to clean it up. But once you've opened up that abscess and it's draining, you don't need to give it any antibiotics. The immune system is going to sort that. You've taken out the nidus of infection. Plus, you know, the antibiotics don't penetrate the abscess anyway. You're not getting into the core of that ball of pus by giving the cat a tablet or a Convenia injection. It's not going to get...
Once if you inject it right into the pus.
Well, to be honest, I'd prefer that. If people are going to shove antibiotics at a catfight abscess, I'd prefer it to be in the abscess than given to all of their bacteria in their whole body. But yeah, there's a big problem with Convenia, and I think it stems from this, you know, owners can't give their cats tablets, which a lot, I would say that the truth of that is that owners don't want to give their cats tablets. I think that most owners can, with the right training, give their cats tablets. What do you guys reckon?
I'm terrible at pulling cats. I don't own a cat, but if I had a cat, if unless it was a super nice one, I'm leaning towards the injections normally when it comes to cats for the clients.
Okay.
Yeah, like I must admit, it's always a question I ask the clients. The vast majority would say, oh, yeah, like I can do it. But then some would say, look, no, the cat is super aggressive and I can't go near it. That's when I would pull it out as one where it's like, if we give him any tablets, he runs away for 3 days and then he doesn't eat and drink and then he gets sick. Or they can't keep him in the house because he will shred the door and then start pissing everywhere. So there's that select kind of like super evil demon cats, right?
And there are some of those, and I think those are always going to be a big challenge. One,
but it sounds like as if you just don't even need to give
If it's a cat bite abscess, and the abscess is open and flushed, you do not need to give antibiotics. At least That's what the literature says. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
In the show notes, you reckon you'd be able to share us some papers that we could put in the show notes? Because that would be, you know, like it took us as a business about a year and a half to stop giving metronidazole or antibiotics to HGE, right? That was 5 or 6 years ago, if not longer. And then we had quite a few client complaints associated with it, because I go back to the referring vet, they would start metronidazole and magically 24 hours the HGE resolves, whereas he's like, if you waited 24 hours, we would have done it anyway. But it took a while for the culture to shift within our practice, but also within our practices that referred to us. Mm-hmm. But the like cat fight anyway, that would be one that would be super cool to roll out. And I have a better idea of how to do that now. It's almost like you give them an information sheet about, you know, cat fight abscesses not needing antibiotics.
Yeah. I think that would be a big win. Now tell me, what are you doing about dentals?
Oh, well, good. The good thing about it is that I never use antibiotics for dentals. You know why?
Because you never do dentals in emergency.
We never do dentals. So,
but before we go dentals, can I just circle back to Convenia? It is very convenient. I'm trying to think, based on what we talked about, the mechanisms of how resistance happen. Why is Convenia bad? If you, let's say you have an instance that does need antibiotics, so it's not a cat abscess, it's got a big swollen cat bite cellulitis and it's got a high fever and I want to give it an antibiotic. Why is Convenia worse than a 5-day course of amoxiclav or something?
So the big problem, Convenia belongs to the third generation cephalosporin group of antibiotics, and it's rated as highest priority, critically important by the WHO. And in a human hospital, you can't prescribe anything in that class without some sort of extra approval. That's what I understand anyway. And the reason why this group of antibiotics is so problematic is because they select for extended spectrum beta-lactamase producing bacteria, ESBLs, you would have hopefully heard of somewhere. You haven't heard of those? Gerardo's shaking his head. No. So ESBLs are really, they're very scary. So rather than just being your average Staph aureus that produces a beta-lactamase and then you have to go from amoxicillin to treating with amoxicillin clavulanate, you have these beta-lactamases that can break down all the cephalosporins. They can break down pretty much all of the penicillin group as well. And then you end up in a situation where you have, for some infections, really almost no options left after that. So you're getting into the territory of having to use those antimicrobials of last resort for infections that have ESBLs. Third generation cephalosporins and fourth generation cephalosporins tend to select for those particular bacteria, which is why we really need to only use them when we absolutely have to. You know, it's frustrating that the only antibiotic that we have that is sort of a whole course in one injection happens to be in the highest importance group of antibiotics. I would have, you know, if it could have been amoxicillin, everyone would have been much happier and better off. But unfortunately, that's not how it happened. But I think, you know, using long-acting amoxicillin, which lasts about 48 hours, is an option for some of those common conditions in cats. So I would say to people who are dealing with, you know, you really cannot tablet this cat, consider whether you might use a couple of long-acting amoxicillin injections 2 days apart. That would cover you for most UTIs. Amoxicillin is so well concentrated in the urine that it would really, like, you would get very high concentrations in the urine from doing that. Otherwise, we should really be trying to teach owners how to tablet their cats, because there was a time before Convenia and cats lived then too.
No. What happens, Convenia just helps keep the little nasty cats alive, you know, the ones. Yeah. So now I think we're selecting for nasty bacteria and nasty cats.
You could do a PhD on that. I mean, I would love to see some of the drug companies work on a longer acting anything that's not a high importance antimicrobial so that we have better options for the really, really feral cats. But I think there's a whole band of, like, actually tabletable cats who are not getting tablets because it's so easy just to give Convenia. And I'd love to kind of move away from that and think either let's really teach this owner how to give tablets. And maybe, Hugh, you're not the person for that if you don't like doing it. But maybe you've got a vet nurse who's really good at it to teach the clients.
Well, actually, no, that's exactly who we get. Totally. They are
usually better at it, to be honest. And, you know, the other thing is that, you know, clients said that vets would sometimes do one demo of like, oh, this is how you give the tablets when you get home. And they'd go, huh, and stick it in. Looks really easy. Don't explain anything. Don't give any handouts. Don't give any links to YouTube videos. Just say, go home and now do that 10 times over the next 5 days. And people get home and they're like, this is a totally different scenario. I actually don't know how to hold my arms over this cat. I vaguely remember they just sort of opened the mouth and popped it in, but they actually don't really know the steps, and no one actually explained how to grab the cat's head, where to grab the cat's head. The fact that once you tilt the head back, the jaw is going to open up. So they're there trying to like pull the jaw open with their fingers, getting bitten and scratched. It's like, if we'd spent a couple of minutes just giving them some proper instruction and maybe getting them to do it in the clinic rather than us just showing them and making it look like it's easy, so that you can say, oh, okay, I can see that you're approaching the cat in this way. What about you try it in this way? We find this works a little bit better. You know, what about we put the cat on a different surface? What about we put the cat's bottom near the wall so it can't back away from us? All of those things that you think are so obvious, but to a client who's never had a cat before, or never had to tablet a cat before, it's not obvious. So we could do a lot better, I think, generally as a profession in teaching people how to do stuff at home.
I want to clarify one thing. So is the worse in terms of its importance than amoxiclav?
Yes, it is. So amoxiclav is rated as medium importance, and Convenia is in the high importance category, along with enrofloxacin. It's interesting that vets seem to really have embraced that, like we shouldn't use fluoroquinolones. People have got that message loud and clear, and fluoroquinolone use is pretty low in Australia, but we haven't really got the message that we shouldn't be using Convenia.
Not to contradict, but we had a discussion with Prof. Jill Madison about antibiotics, and she talked about this. She said, we shouldn't be throwing it around just like amoxiclav. We shouldn't be throwing around. She said that it's still better than missing every second day's antibiotic dose because you can't find the cat because it's run away or something. Rather that than have missed doses of antibiotics, skip a day, the late dose, something like that.
I think you've hit the core of the Zoetis marketing right there. It's better to make sure you get the whole course than to have potentially missed doses.
Well, at least not missed doses. She didn't say. She said it's way too long. We don't need 2 weeks. It's an excessively long course for most things. And she's in the same boat as you. We had this discussion because she was saying we abuse antibiotics. But then she said people get really upset about Convenia, and she'd rather the cat gets its 3-4 days of antibiotics, and I give it, and then tonight I can't get it in, and then tomorrow the cat's outside, and it's just sort of. She said, rather get it in or don't do it than sort of half-ass.
Look, I think that's a fair point. But what about in that cat? If we taught the owners how to give the tablets, they gave it their best shot and they went home and they couldn't give the amoxicillin tablets. What if they called up and said, can't get the amoxicillin tablets in? What can we do? And you said, can you bring the cat back in? We'll give it a long-acting amoxicillin injection today and again on Wednesday. Yep. Would that an option?
I just reckon that just sounds much better to begin with. Like, unless the cat's a demon to put in the cage and to bring back in, but like this long-acting amoxicillin, I never heard of this stuff.
It's a cow thing. You've never done mixed practice before.
No, I've never treated a horse, never treated a cow.
I think it's just called Betamox LA, isn't it? Like, it's available for small animals.
Yeah, you're right. It is. It's just not an emergency drug. It's not a drug you'll see on the shelf in most.
Oh, I'd love to see it on more shelves. The other thing that I'd love you to order, tell me, have you got trimethoprim sulfonamide on the shelf?
Yeah.
That's good. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, we use that.
Because that's a really good choice for urinary tract infections. And people are scared of it because, you know, KCS in whatever Doberman Pinschers, I can't even remember what breed we're supposed to, all of these, and hepatopathies, those things do happen, but they happen with longer courses than are recommended in the guidelines. So sure, if you treat for 14 days, you're running some heavy risks of some complications from those, from the sulfonamide component. But if you use 3 days for a urinary tract infection, which is recommended, you're almost certainly not going to get those complications. So all this idea of let's first look at the guidelines, which have much shorter durations than we've been traditionally using, it reduces side effects. It then opens up possibilities in terms of using drugs that we're scared of using because of potential side effects. It also makes it a lot easier for owners who don't enjoy tableting their cats or have trouble remembering. If they only have to remember for 3 days or struggle with their cat for 3 days, that's a lot more doable than 7 days or 10 days, right? Like, it just becomes a much smaller problem when you have a shorter duration, which is more appropriate in most cases.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I apologize if it sounded like I was argumentative. The reason I'm harping on about it is I know what happens. You listen to this, you're in a busy practice, and you go, well, that's interesting. I shouldn't be doing that, but it's so fucking convenient. And the clients, I mean, you, as you say, we used to do fine without it, but we also used to do fine without mobile phones. Don't try and take that away from people.
Never.
So unless we have a decent, not super inconvenient alternative, people will just say, yeah, I probably shouldn't be doing it, but I'm still going to do it.
Yeah.
It's just so easy.
I think that's true. And it might take more than a year for people to get out of the habit. Yeah. But I would point out that the label of convenience says you should only use it when you've done a CNS that says you need to use this drug.
Yeah, okay.
And yeah. I can tell you now that almost never is that the case in veterinary practice in Australia. We've looked at CNS, people using CNS and people using Convenia, and those things are not aligned. People are generally not doing CNS before applying Convenia. And it's problematic. I mean, I don't want to put the fear of God into people, but we do not want to encourage ESBLs in our animals. It is not going to turn out well for us.
I think you picked a really good color. I'm looking at your guidelines here, and it's red is kind of like a good color, yeah, for like don't touch. Like, you know, like I don't feel like I even want to touch the bottle anymore now in the fridge. But you got black here.
Yeah.
What's black?
Black is really, you shouldn't go there. I mean, that is, it's got to be life-saving. It's got to be a life-saving situation. And really, I mean, those are things like carbapenems, imipenem. Like these are in human medicine last resort drugs, and should really be last resort in veterinary medicine as well.
Yeah, except with the branding of black, it does make it sound pretty special. So I'm like, if I ever get sick, I want the black one.
I want the black one now. I got a cold. I think I need the black. I need the black antibiotics for my cold.
It is funny. You said earlier the concept of having a stronger antibiotic. And it is a funny thing to think of antibiotics as being stronger or weaker, because that's not really how they work. You know, they either do affect a certain type of bacterium or don't. And I think when things are broader spectrum, that doesn't necessarily make them more effective or stronger. But you're right. Some people do want something, the newest one or the strongest one or whatever, and we need to get them out of that mindset. We need to be saying, actually, the aim here is let's go narrow, let's go low importance, and let's go short duration.
Yeah, which is a mind shift, but I think it's vital to listen to this.
Obviously, we'll attach to the show notes the guidelines, but I literally just Googled Agriculture Victoria antibiotics. And then it just came up as, yeah,
traffic light this card.
Little 7-page flip
book. You've got the flip book, yeah. And there's some little cards, some A4 poster things with the three dots, the green, yellow, and red dots showing the different antibiotics that are available for those species.
You asked about dentals earlier. Why did you ask, what do we use for dentals?
Oh, because when I worked in mixed practice, we gave, and this is a classic example of, you know, habit-based sort of myth-based prescribing. We used to give every dental 7 days of antimicrobials before the dental and then another 7 days after. Is that still a thing?
Well, I haven't done GP practice for decades.
But if I was getting a dental, I would want that.
Yeah.
So I was poking the bear. Just poking the bear. But is it like some kind of endocarditis kind of thing?
So that's the idea is if you've got the animal's got really bad valvular disease that you have to protect it from the spray of bacteria that are going to come off in this dental into the bloodstream. But actually, it's not that. It's not critical. There are a couple of instances where and these are in the prescribing guidelines that you're going to post on this. There are a couple of instances where you might consider giving antibiotics at the time of the dental. You certainly do not need to pre-dose anyone before a dental, and almost all cases will not require any antibiotics at all. So you'd want to have a really immunocompromised, really problematic animal before you started thinking about giving antibiotics for a dental. You know, we all know how good the blood supply is to the mouth. You just don't need them. The immune system is going to sort it.
What about the common practice of antibiotics during surgery, clean surgery? Or let's say you're doing a big egg slap or something like that. If it's more than 90 minutes, then it should have an antibiotic because the length of anesthetic increases infection risk. Is there anything that counteracts or supports that?
The timing of giving the antibiotics is really important for surgery. So you actually need to reach sort of peak plasma levels of the antibiotic at the time you make your cut. And the mistake that most vets are making is giving it much later, say around the time of making the cut is when you might chuck in the cefazolin. And that is too late in the procedure to have the best effect. So you actually need to be doing it about 30 minutes prior to your cut. And that's in the guidelines as well. It depends on which agent you're using and which way you're delivering it. But if you're giving, I think IV cefazolin, it's about half an hour beforehand that you should be giving it. But check the guidelines for that. But generally speaking, what you're saying is correct about the length of the surgery does matter as well.
I just actually got your guidelines up here, and they're super good. What it says is like the timing, though, so 60 minutes, 30, 60 minutes prior, right? But if you got ciprofloxacin, it's actually every 4 hours. So it's just like sometimes it takes me 4 hours to do a surgery if the dog's been mauled to pieces by three other dogs and a dragon and a dinosaur all at the same time. But if it's like a simple laparotomy, removing the foreign body, you're in and out in less than an hour.
You're not going to need that second dose.
Wow.
I feel like I need a cup of tea and my comfort blanket to go and process some of these things.
Oh, this is exciting. I'm like, can't wait to like share this around the hospital going, hey, this is what we're going
to
do now.
I would love you to share it. I would love vets to know about the guidelines because the ones I interviewed only probably 2 out of 22 had actually heard of these guidelines. A lot of them had heard or had a copy of some drug company sponsored guidelines, which coincidentally recommended some.
Use this Enroflox, use this, Vequinol, and then.
It was amazing how many applications there were for their particular antibiotics. But I think we probably need to get these ones out there. These are not sponsored by any drug companies and they are based on evidence. I mean, I have to say that in veterinary medicine, as you know, there's hardly any money for research. So often the evidence base is fairly thin, but wherever research is being done, we're finding that there are ways to reduce the causes, to reduce the importance of the antibiotics that we're using. I want the guidelines to get out there as far and wide as possible and for people to actually look at them and think about how they might alter what they're doing without risking patient health. We don't want animals to be suffering longer than they need to. We don't want animals to be not treated with genuine infections. That is not the aim of antimicrobial stewardship. We're not saying stop using antibiotics. You must use less. What we're saying is when they're not needed, don't use them because that's just sort of pissing against a wall.
It's basically stop being lazy because it is important. Because that's what it is, really. If I have to confess for myself, even if it's in the back of my head, if it's not important, I'll go, I've heard of this stuff, but I'm really busy and I just want to get on, and I don't want people to complain. And so I'm just really being a bit lazy.
Yes.
Okay, well, have something.
I'm going to take the Convenia bottle out of my pocket and stop using the early console now.
Doesn't it have to be refrigerated?
Oh, shit, I didn't know that. Oh, now it's...
Gerardo, we should see if we can get Zoetis to sponsor this episode. Thank you so much for that, Ree. I love your work and I love your passion, and it's one of those things that you know is really important, and we should probably just be a little bit more mindful about it. If you enjoyed Getting Smarter while you were driving or doing whatever it was you were doing while you were listening to that episode, then you'll probably love our clinical podcasts. Look, we all struggle to keep up to date with the hundreds of things that we feel we should know to be the competent and confident vets we want to be. It's very easy to find yourself feeling rusty and out of touch, which is why we create the Vet Vault Clinical Podcast. Well, first of all, it's for selfish reasons, so we can stay up to date. But we're pretty sure that it will help you too, regardless where you are in your veterinary journey. If you haven't heard about it yet, we do 3 podcasts a week. One in small animal medicine, one in surgery, and one in emergency and critical care. We chat to world-class specialists to deliver all the key concepts and insights that you need to be the sharpest tool in the shed, right into your ear holes every week, backed by beautiful show notes that you can refer back to later. Go to vvn.supercast.com for your free 2-week trial.